the podcast that watched Christmas.
Hello, and welcome to episode 42 of If This Is a Podcast, Then What's Christmas? Today, I'm speaking to Jay Cohen Gilbert, which makes this episode slightly unusual because it's not an interview with an advertising personality, and it's not really a startup chat either, although there's plenty of startup advice here. The point of this conversation is that I think it would really benefit lots of people, lots of things, to consider a wider range of what companies are here for, what we're here for, what the benefits that we could possibly create out of our work might be, and how to go about doing that. I think, you know, particularly in my own career in advertising, I certainly, particularly when I was younger, didn't really pay that much attention to the wider world. You know, you want to create ads, you want to see those ads have an impact, maybe win awards for them, climb up the ladder, that kind of thing. But the older I've got, the more I've seen the wider context of what we can do and what we should be doing. And it's not just me getting, inverted commas, wiser or older or anything like that. It's also that the conversation around, for want of a better word, ethics, or, you know, doing good with a corporation, has just got louder and louder and louder, particularly over the last 10 years. You know, the way things are in the world right now, we can't really deny or ignore the need to take into account the impact our actions have on the rest of the people living on the planet. So with that in mind, you know, have a listen to my chat with Jay, have a look on the blog, check the links, that kind of thing, and maybe just consider some of the things that are being said, some of the arguments, some of the ways of looking at something that you might not have, you know, looked at them in that way before. I hope you enjoy it. I hope you get something out of it, and I hope perhaps this conversation takes things further for you. Cheers. Well, thanks so much for making the time to chat to me, Jay. It's very kind.
Pleasure, Ben. Excited to be here.
Great. Well, as B Corp and B Corporation and the B Lab and that whole area may be familiar to some people who are listening to this, I'm pretty sure it will be unfamiliar to others. So I have a feeling you may have done this before, but could you give us a little potted description of what the whole thing is about and maybe how it came about?
Sure. So the B Corp movement is a movement to redefine success in business so that companies are now no longer competing just to be best in the world, but to be best for the world. So that means best for their workers, best for the community, best for the environment. And the objective or the vision of that movement is that together we'll build a more inclusive economy that creates opportunity for all, and as a result creates a more shared and durable prosperity. And so that's what the B Corp movement is. And the leaders of that movement are the companies themselves that are certified B Corporations. There are about a little over 2,000 of them, about 2,200 of them around the world in about 150 different countries. Excuse me, about 50 different countries and about 150 different industries. And they range from small sole proprietors to large publicly traded multinational companies. And so really, any business, no matter what business they're in, can use their business as a force for good. And the B Corp mark is a way that they can signal to their current or prospective employees or to customers or to investors that this is the kind of company that they'd like to work for, buy from, invest in.
That sounds great. I would just like to go back to your previous career a little bit, where you started was it just basketball wear, or was it other?
It was a basketball footwear and apparel company called And One.
Yeah, and I think, like I was saying this question before, I'm kind of interested in this because in reading the B Corp book, apparently Nike had a meeting where they wanted to, I've forgotten what the word you used was, but something along the lines of crush or destroy or end your company. I think that's really interesting because that came around this sort of slightly post no logo time when Nike's ethical stance was under scrutiny anyway. I wonder how you feel about whether that's just fair game capitalism, Nike crushing you, or whether it's kind of a little bit off for them to take a company that is doing good things for the world and ending it because it reduces their bottom line.
Yeah, I think that's a fair and kind of fun question that I've never thought about before, quite honestly. So congratulations on the new question there. My sense is that the answer is twofold. The first is, I think at the core of capitalism and a market economy is fair competition. And so B Corps are no different from any other company, and they're not immune to the market forces of supply and demand and customer or investor interest. And so B Corps have to compete. And one, which of course wasn't a B Corp at the time because it didn't exist, but And One had to compete with Nike. And just because And One was doing great things for its employees or the workers in the factories or doing cool charitable giving or whatever it might have been, you know, doesn't give us a license to operate. We still have to deliver things that people want at a price they can afford in a convenient and timely way. And so that competitive fire helps us all be better. And it forces us to constantly improve our products. And so I don't think we didn't begrudge Nike that sort of competitive energy when they set their sights on us at N1. And nor would I begrudge any company from trying to take market share, you know, from another company, whether it be B Corp or not. I think that's just that is the nature of the market economy, and the benefits of that competition, I think, far outweigh the negatives. That being said, I think in the context of a B economy, in the context of an economy that's focused on creating value not only for shareholders but also for society, I think what you'll see is companies choosing to seek cooperative advantage, not just competitive advantage. And that could take the form of companies like New Belgium Brewing or Ben & Jerry's creating cool combined flavors of ice cream or beer and helping each other find new customers and make their customers more sticky. It could take the form of a group of 20 or 30 B Corps together working on a collective brand awareness campaign to take that to retail in the grocery channel. It can work where companies that are even like next door neighbor competitors, like Method and Seventh Generation, both selling, you know, terrific household cleaning products, actually work together to get benefit corporation legislation passed, you know, in their respective states and in Delaware. And so I think that when you're operating in a B economy or with a B Corp mindset, while you are competing for market share and buyers' attention and consumer wallets, I think you also look for areas where you can cooperate to create potentially more good together than each of you could have done alone. And those are just a couple examples. So I think it's not an either or, it's a yes and answer to your question.
Yeah, I mean, I think that you're right. It's a kind of bit of a gray area because you're right. You shouldn't necessarily have a right to exist if, you know, the market doesn't kind of allow it. But you're then in a sort of other area of capitalism also where, say, a giant comes into your category, like, say, Amazon or Starbucks, and sort of crushes the surrounding retail competition so that it has, you know, nothing to compete against it. Yeah. But it does that using, you know, could you consider it to be an unfair amount of leverage or strength? And I do understand that, you know, a sort of laissez-faire attitude to economics does work in that way. But at the same time, some companies have a sort of unfair disadvantage, or some people might say any advantage is unfair. So, you know, I guess that's the question I'm coming from.
Yeah, no, I think that's a great question. And that's now we're into a little bit more nuanced question, right? There's fair and unfair competition, you know, and I would say nothing that Nike did with N1 was unfair competition, you know. But I am aware of other folks in that industry and other industries that adopt unfair competitive practices. And I think that if you were doing business as a B Corp, you would be thinking not only about the dynamics between your company and your bottom line, but you would also be thinking about, and you'd be legally obligated to think about the impact of your decisions on communities. And so if one of the consequences of you coming into a market is that you obliterate all other local businesses and there's a net negative effect on wages, let's say, or benefits and full compensation, if you were a B Corp, you would be legally obligated to be taking that into consideration as you developed your go-to-market strategy. And so I think that some of those sort of negative externalities, what are currently viewed in economics term as negative externalities, to call them like ultra competitive, if not unfair, business practices. I think some of those would be altered as a result of operating within a new legal framework, which is a stakeholder governance framework of the B Corporation, as opposed to a shareholder governance framework, which is traditional corporation. So I think some of that would be handled differently because the company would be a B Corp. The other piece of it is, of course, there are existing regulations in place in different jurisdictions around the world that are there to protect consumers and communities from unfair labor practices or environmental practices, et cetera. And again, while it's at some level, it's up to citizens to vote for those governments that create the kinds of regulatory regimes that they want that provide some guardrails on corporate behavior, I think it's also fair to say that if a company is a certified B Corporation, they are going to be also operating in a more transparent way in how they engage with government agencies and regulators, so that you would have less of sort of the risk of government regulation being co-opted by single-mindedly bottom-line focused corporations, because the corporation is now no longer single bottom-line focused and it's legally obligated to disclose those kinds of practices. And so for all of those reasons, I think that while it doesn't – well, certainly B Corps are part of a free market economy. I think they're helping us migrate from a purist, absolutist free market economy, which actually only exists in textbooks, doesn't exist in the real world, to a more of a fair market economy, where we're not only relying on government regulation, but we're importantly relying on individual companies and the individuals in them to act responsibly, and we're giving them a legal structure and a transparency regime that's helping to reinforce that kind of pro-social, pro-community behavior from corporations that makes them more trustworthy than they are today.
Yeah, I think that moving from shareholder into stakeholder is a kind of critical thing for where we are now, because shareholder obviously just tends to come down to money, and stakeholder comes down to valuing human beings and obviously the planet that we live on, which is, to me, you know, it's a kind of no-brainer how that should be something that we're focused on as people here. And because that is a great thing, you know, B Corp in what it's done and how it's spreading around and the speed it's moving at, I think are really, really important. So could you give us a little idea of how you managed to make yourselves international and maybe the things that you've got in place to keep the speed of your growth going?
Sure. That's a great question. We'd always envisioned the B Corp movement as a global movement, and the inclusive economy that we want to create is a global economy. I think one of the fun things that happened last year was it was the year where there for the first time became more B Corps outside of the U.S. than inside the U.S. And we thought that was a great milestone to mark in the globalization of the B Corp movement. And that rapid growth of B Corps outside the U.S. Is only happening because of local leadership. There's nothing that B-Lab is sitting here doing in the U.S. that's driving interest and growth in the B Corp movement in Latin America or Asia or Europe. That's all happening because there are local leaders in each of those regions who have said, the B Corp movement speaks to me. This is the kind of economy we want. This is the kind of society we want. These are the kinds of businesses that either we are or that we want to see more of, and we want to see more of. And so they've asked us, how can we help grow the movement in our area? And so what we do here at B-Lab is we create sort of a global platform that each of those regional partners can run with in their regions, in local countries or cities. And so that the group in Latin America is called Sistema B, and there were four incredible entrepreneurs who came to us from three different countries in Latin America all at the same time and said, we're inspired and we want to get to know each other. We took about a year or two to get to know each other, dated before we got engaged and got engaged before we got married, but now we're happily married to our friends at Sistema B. And they've got hundreds of B Corps throughout Latin America that are doing absolutely incredible things on their own. And I'd say as if not more importantly, collectively, they're doing things that we didn't dream of here in the States. And so we're actually learning from them and incorporating into our model here in North America some incredible things that they're doing in South America. And similarly in Australia, New Zealand, and in Europe and the UK. And we just opened up earlier this year offices in East Africa. Wow. And while there had been B Corps in Africa before, there had not been any local office, local support. And so it's only with sort of boots on the ground, with feet on the ground in those regions, with local entrepreneurs leading the way, that we can build a vibrant community of leaders that inspires others to follow. And so our job is really to figure out how to be responsive to and supportive of that local leadership wherever it shows up around the world.
That makes a lot of sense. Have you found that there's a little bit of a tricky transition from talking to people who are already into this, some people might say preaching to the choir, and spreading it out to a wider audience? Because I do feel the public is ready for this, and this conversation is something that to some degree they're receptive to. But to have it spread, effectively, I guess you've got to start talking to people who may not be as positively disposed towards it. Have you found that's a tricky thing to tackle?
For sure, Ben, you put your finger on it. Like, I think that's the inflection point that we're at right now. The first 10 years of the B Corp movement have been largely, as you said, preaching to the choir or, sort of what people would call the early adopters, right? The innovators and early adopters in any market transformation. And if you read the books about this kind of sort of growth, they talk about the need for these for any kind of trend or product that that only a few get accepted by those innovators and early adopters. Even fewer are able to cross the chasm to be attractive to what folks call the early majority. And it's really that, navigating that path and crossing that chasm that will, at the end of the day, be the mark as to whether or not the B Corp movement is able to affect the kind of global culture shift and system change that we seek. If in 10 years' time we're still talking to just preaching to the converted, wherever they are around the world, we will have failed. And so we've got to transform our products, our language, the way we work with each other to translate effectively into a new marketplace, let's call them the early majority, who aren't necessarily doing this first and foremost because they think it's the right thing to do. And so things like the business case need to be more clear, and of course, always make them more compelling over time. And so, whether it's folks who are new to issues of corporate social responsibility, impact investing, sustainability, et cetera, or whether it's folks who have been aware of those things but work in much larger organizations who move much more slowly and are almost by definition more conservative and prudent in their effort, I think that's the inflection point we're at right now. Like over the last 18, 24 months, we have gotten, you know, a tenfold increase at least in the amount of inbound inquiries we're getting from large Fortune 500 companies around the world. That didn't happen, you know, 3, 5, 7 years ago. And now that's happening every week. And that means that we've got to learn how to speak a large corporate language, learn how to make our standards meaningful and manageable for companies of that size and scope and complexity, while not lowering our standards and thus sort of reducing the value of the certification as we extend its reach. Like the only path for us is a path where we can scale with integrity. And that means scaling with the most rigorous set of social and environmental performance standards, a true new legal framework that holds companies accountable for their impact on society, not just their shareholders, and the kind of transparency that gives workers, customers, and investors the kind of access to information that they'd have to make their own decision as to whether this is the kind of company that deserves their support. And so all of those things have to happen. We just can't go chasing shiny objects and large checkbooks, you know, or else we'll be ourselves co-opted and we'll have failed.
Sure. I guess when you're talking to companies that are already established, part of that establishment is probably a kind of financial imperative that they have. And sure. To get them to convert themselves from a kind of cash generation entity to one that will compromise the financial side of it for a greater good. Is that a harder challenge than taking things that are starting as new and you know, setting them off in the right direction from the very beginning?
So it's a great question, but I'd probably disagree with maybe an inadvertent premise that you articulated in your question, which was the presumption, which I think is false, that pursuing positive social or environmental impact is going to be a negative impact on your finances. Sure. I don't think that's true. And I think we have B Corps all around the world that have proven that that's actually not true. These folks are rock stars of a new economy because they're both competing on, you know, in the marketplace, and they're fast growing and highly profitable, attracting a ton of outside capital. And at the same time, they are creating tremendous social and environmental impact. And so I don't think it's an either or. I think that's a false choice and a little bit of a myth that needs to be busted. B Corps wouldn't have raised $1 billion in the public and private equity markets in the last 24 months if they weren't a good return on investment. You know, those investors are not doing it altruistically. They are fiduciaries for other people's money that are interested in making more money. The difference is they want to make more money while not having a negative impact on the world, and some of them are actually wanting to make money and make a positive impact at the same time. And while certainly in some instances there are trade-offs to make, more and more investors are willing to look at those trade-offs, particularly when they have rigorous social and environmental metrics they can look at that might justify a trade-off. There aren't always trade-offs, and in many cases, B Corps are actually higher performers than traditional corporations. One example in the U.S. is during the global financial crisis and the 5 years after that, that in the U.S. we call the Great Recession, B Corps were 63% more likely to have survived the Great Recession than traditional small businesses in the U.S. And so you can't thrive unless you've actually survived. And so if B Corps have nearly two-thirds more likely to survive a financial crisis, that resiliency translates into returns, because for those other companies, their return is zero. They're gone. Those B Corps are still around living to fight another day. And as I mentioned before, B Corps are raising tons of money, not only because they're creating positive social environmental impact, but also because they're doing that and generating meaningful returns for investors. And many of those investors are mainstream, hard-headed, sharp-elbowed venture capitalists from Silicon Valley. and large sort of, disembodied third-party institutional investors in the public markets, both of whose fiduciary duty is to generate market rate returns for their clients, and they're finding they can do that by investing in B corporations. So most importantly, Ben, I just want to be careful that people don't make the false assumption that B corps are less profitable in many cases, and many investors think that actually, and particularly over the long run, that investing in B corps is actually the most prudent kind of investment you can make. And it's actually B corps are more likely to create long-term value than other companies. So that would be the most important point I'd want to make in response to that question.
Well, that's a really good thing to clear out, because I think in some people's minds, I mean, although say you switch from a lot of fossil fuel situations at the moment to renewable energy, they are cheaper alternatives. And yet then you may have a company that goes, well, for us to really make some sort of figures that Wall Street's expecting us to make, we have to lay off 500 people. And I think that there's maybe, again, a gray area within those decisions that are being made where, you know, if you want to survive as a company, you may have to do things that aren't necessarily nice to people. And that's going to happen. You know, if you either your company dies with all the people that you're still employed with, or you lose some people and your company can survive. I think I'm trying to make the point here that the decision isn't always black and white. There may be some benefits and some problems with the same decision.
Yeah, and I think the last thing you said, Ben, is the most important, is none of this is black and white. And so whether it was through my own experience at AN1, or if you read about Patagonia's experience in the late 80s, and many other companies, that go through these, like companies go through a life cycle. They have challenges, whether they're self-inflicted wounds or increased competition or changing external environment. And so what B Corp does is it makes sure it requires management and boards to make those decisions, taking into consideration the impact of those decisions on all of the stakeholders, not just the shareholders. And so when AND1 or Patagonia went through a difficult time and had to do layoffs, we'd like to think that we did them in a mindful way, that we knew that this was crappy news for the people that weren't going to be working at AND1 anymore, as an example. But how we did that, as it pertains to severance and outplacement services and notice and all of those other things, can make a huge difference as to whether people land on their feet or don't. And if you read the studies on what happens to people after they lose their jobs, how quickly they get back in the labor force can have a huge impact on long-term, on lifetime earnings potential. And the longer people are out of work, it can have significantly an escalating negative impact on their lifetime earnings. And so it's not that layoffs are always the wrong thing to do for a company, but there are more and less humane ways to do that. And if the context of those decisions is how do we create a positive impact on all of our stakeholders, including our employees, community, environment, then I think companies will even go through difficult times in a different way. And there are other examples than the one I just gave about layoffs. There can also be times, and I know this happened at a B Corp, whose name I can't disclose, but it happens to be another B Corp in the footwear industry, that was going through difficult times, and their executive team actually decided that they were going to reduce their own compensation for a period in order to avoid layoffs. And so that's an example of a company making a very explicit decision to save jobs in a difficult environment. And I venture to say that not every company does that. And so whether it's helping to preserve jobs by looking at other ways to save money, or if you do end up realize that you have to, for a variety of reasons, make some cuts, doing them in a more humane way to help people land on their feet, I think that those are also part of what operating in a B Corp or living in a B economy would do for us, is it make it a little bit, it sort of sand down the rough edges in an otherwise fairly heartless, amoral marketplace.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Let me just nudge this a little bit towards my industry, or the industry I've worked in for over 20 years. That's advertising, I guess, advertising and marketing. I was looking through your assessment criteria, and one of the interesting questions you have is one about the social environmental performance of significant suppliers. Now, to be an ad agency, in effect, you are a company, but also a supplier. Intrinsically, the job is being a supplier to other clients. How do you feel it works when you are good yourself and yet you may have to do your work on behalf of a company that doesn't hold the same principles as you?
That's a great question. And it shows up for lots of B2B businesses, not just folks in advertising, marketing, communication space. But I appreciate the question. I don't know. There are probably 30 or 40 different B Corps in the marketing, communications, and branding PR space. And most of them have clients, many clients that aren't B Corps, right? And some of them that are large companies that folks might think of as being far away from sort of a purist interpretation of the B Corp movement. And so I'd say a couple things. One is, most importantly, is one of the most important things that a B Corp marketing or advertising firm might do is to make sure that there were no misleading claims being made by a non-B Corp, let's say, or even a B Corp for that matter, right? But one of the reasons why the B Corp certification existed was to combat greenwashing, which I'm sure you and your listeners know that term. Folks who are saying they're one thing, but they're actually, their practices are quite different. The B Corp certification is designed to eliminate greenwashing because it's third-party verification for folks' actual performance. And I think what a marketing firm has a responsibility to do, certainly if they're a B Corp, but I'd argue this for any marketing firm, is to not help companies tell falsehoods about themselves. I'd say in the current sort of digital world, where everything is transparent and we have a super empowered citizen consumer, I think that would be a pretty much of one of the seven deadly sins of advertising anyway, because folks are going to find out. and they've never had more power than they do today through social media. And so just again, whether they're a B Corp or not, as a marketing firm, if I were advising any company and they had a CMO who was a little slippery with the facts or wanting to claim a little bit of a different position than actually was true, I would advise against that, whether I was a B Corp or not. Not because it's unethical, although I would argue that's true, but I'd argue because it's ineffective. And actually, it will actually create more problems and reduce brand value in the long run, because in an age of radical transparency, people will find out when there's daylight between what you say and what you do, and then you've got a big target on your chest, and once you do something like that, it's very hard to rebuild trust with your customers. And so forget about the ethical element of it or the B Corp certification. I'd say just it's bad business to do that. But certainly from a B Corp perspective, I think there's probably a heightened awareness of that they don't want to sort of aid and abet that kind of greenwashing. And the flip side of that is there are a lot of big companies doing amazing things, or at least who want to move in that direction. And if you've got a B Corp firm working with you in whatever part of your business, lawyer, finance, marketing, tech, whatever it might be, if you want to move in the direction of building a more inclusive business, right, and having your practices be more sustainable, no better company to partner with than somebody who's technically proficient at what they do, but also values aligned. And so because they're a B Corp, they might be able to help you see things that you don't see yourself. They've got access to the wisdom of a community of practice that's best in class around the world, and they can bring that knowledge to your company much more quickly than you going out and trying to acquire that on your own. And so there's some real advantages to working with B Corps. And B Corps want to work with folks that are even taking their first steps. Because our objective is not that everybody becomes a B Corp. That would be like the height of arrogance and sort of ridiculousness. Like, no, not every company in the world is going to be a B Corp. That's not what success looks like. Success looks like every company competing to be best for the world and trying to use their business as a force for good and working on continuous improvement. And so B Corps recognize that because they know that they're not perfect. And so if they can help a company take its first steps down that path, then that's a privilege and actually a pretty high impact thing for B Corps to do. And so there's certainly no reason why B Corps shouldn't work with non-B Corps. And often in some ways, non-B Corps are seeking out B Corps to work with because the B Corps can help them achieve their business objectives and be the change that they want to see in the world.
Yeah, I think it's very interesting that you mentioned greenwashing and again, working on behalf of larger companies and perhaps guiding them in the right direction. It seems to me, and I may be being overly cynical or skeptical here, that there are companies that like to do a sort of moral greenwashing where they will have initiatives that are seen to be positive that kind of are there to address, to sort of balance on the kind of other side of the seesaw of what they're doing that's somewhat negative. Is it actually more harm than good to be providing a sort of mask of niceness for these companies that may not otherwise be like that? And they may be trying to do these nice things just because it actually makes them a bit more money and they're really being, again, financially a little bit cynical themselves.
Sure. And so setting aside like motivation, you know, whether it's financial or social, I think we all have to be wary of being used and manipulated and co-opted, whether we're as investors or, you know, employees or as consumers. And so I think that we ought to be cynical and skeptical because certainly the last several decades of corporate history would tell us that we have every reason to be cynical and skeptical of what corporations say about themselves. And if you look at trust barometers, trust in corporations is at an all-time low in the history of that kind of market research. And the bigger the organization, the lower the trust. And so whether it's us as citizens or as companies deciding who we want to work with, you know, one of the questions that we envision folks asking, you know, is why aren't you a B Corp? Or what are you doing to measure and manage your impact as an entire business? I hear about this great program that you're doing, and that's wonderful. But I'd love to know how you guys approach your company's social and environmental footprint. And I'd love to know how you measure and manage that, not just about this one individual program. And I think that that doesn't mean the company has to be a B Corp, but it may mean that that company is using some of the tools of the B Corp movement, like the B impact assessment as a measurement and management tool. And so there's a huge company out of South America, like the third largest commercial bank in Latin America called Banco Colombia, something like $55 or $60 billion worth of assets under management. And they are not going to become a certified B Corp anytime soon, but they very much want to be a part of the B Corp movement, and they're using the B impact assessment to help their several hundred of their top suppliers. In that case, that means the people that they're lending money to, right? Commercial loans, and introducing them to the B impact assessment so they can measure and manage their impact with real credibility. That's a fantastic program. And it has nothing to do with anybody ever becoming a B Corp, but it does have to do with all companies beginning to measure and manage their impact with as much rigor as their profits, and having a company like Banco Colombia as an active, engaged member of the B Corp movement is as wonderful as it is to have a huge Fortune 500 company like Danone saying that they aspire to actually become certified one day and have already gotten three or four of their subsidiaries certified. And just as powerful as it is to have the latest VC-funded tech startup be born B from the very beginning and be certified. Like, each of those three things are very different ways for companies to engage with the B Corp movement. but they're all equally valid because they're all like credible and rigorous attempts to measure and manage impact, not just sort of a fig leaf to cover otherwise, you know, nether activities.
Sure. I think it's interesting that you brought up banking there, because when I talk to friends about over here in the West Coast, you have the Beneficial State Bank, which is great and is doing really good work. But when I talk to friends about whether they want to join it, there's this big question of convenience that comes up, whether it's in the number of ATMs or where the branches are or whatever. And they go back to, without naming any names, banks that, let's say, have compromised themselves in certain ways, perhaps morally or whatever. So is banking a hard kind of thing to square for companies that want to be B Corps and have that aspect to their business?
You know, it's a great point. And obviously, like, you know, commercial banking from personal banking are two different marketplaces. But and there are, I want to say, 6 or 8 B Corp banks around the world. But obviously, not everybody has access to them, right? Depending upon where you live and depending upon those banks' sort of service profile, right, for the things that you mentioned. Mm. That being said, I'd say that when we on the B Impact Assessment, we ask companies whether they work with either a B Corp bank or another, I forget exactly the language we use, another values aligned bank. And the reason why we expand the definition there and give people credit for moving their money to banks that are positive force in their communities is because we know that that's not only B Corp banks. And so, for instance, in the U.S. legal context, there are community development banks, there are co-op banks, there are credit unions, and there are banks that are local, right? Another way to talk about community banks. And so each of those different kinds of banks, we have made a value judgment, our standards advisory council has made a value judgment that working with any one of those types of banks creates more positive impact the world than working with a large multinational bank that is neither local nor has it a part of an association like the Global Alliance for Banking on Values, nor is it a credit union or a community development bank. All of those things have actual standards associated with them that have enabled us to make a judgment that working with any one of those banks is a more powerful positive act than just defaulting to the most convenient branch. But that being said, completely agree with you, Ben, that moving our money is one of the most difficult things we can do. Understandably, we're most cautious about that, and that's a good thing. But also because the global financial institutions are so huge and ubiquitous, and it's difficult to extricate ourselves from that financial system. The good news is that between all those other types of banks, including a growing number of B Corp banks, it's easier and easier to move your money. But that doesn't mean that it's the easiest thing you're going to be able to do next week, whether it's for your own personal finances or for your corporate finances. We were able to do that at B-Lab. Like, we work with a Beneficial State Bank that you mentioned and also another West Coast bank called New Resource Bank. And they meet, you know, we're about a $9 million entity with about 65 employees. So we're bigger than most businesses in the U.S. We're obviously still a small entity, but most businesses are actually smaller. And we're able to meet our commercial banking needs just fine without a local ATM or whatever. But, you know, not all companies are able to do that or are comfortable with that. And that's fine. And so in that case, almost every community will have a community bank, a local bank, or a credit union in their area, and any of those choices are a better choice than just banking as usual.
Yeah, I think that makes a lot of sense. I guess people have there's subjective definitions of what, you know, I don't want to use the word ethical, but what a good company could be. How did you come up with your list of assessment criteria, and what were there things that did and didn't make the cut, or there were things that were argued about quite a long time about whether they should be included or not?
Yeah, there are things that are still argued about. You know, the only thing that we know about our standards is that they're imperfect. And we subscribe to the motto that perfect is the enemy of the good. And the world needs a good set of standards that's committed to continuous improvement and a sound and transparent governance structure. It needs that much more than it needs a perfect set of standards. And so the B impact assessment, which are the performance standards that are used for certification, those are administered by an independent group called the Standards Advisory Council. And we're now in the middle of creating version 6 of the standards. So they version kind of like software every 24 to 36 months. The next version will show up in January of 2018. And that stuff is argued about all the time, as it should be. Like the whole field of impact measurement, right, or measuring our impact on all of our stakeholders, it's a very new field. And so we're learning every day. And we get better at how to ask questions so they're more clear. We get better at recognizing the holes in the standards that we need to fill. And we get better at recognizing which questions we might have thought were important, but 3 or 4 years into it, we realize we're not as important or correlated with high impact, and those get eliminated. So we are very much subscribe to a philosophy of continuous improvement. And recognize that we'd be the first to poke holes in our own standards. They just happen to be the most rigorous and comprehensive standards around. If there were others that were more rigorous or more comprehensive, we'd gladly use them instead of ours. It would save us a lot of time and money and angst. But right now, we oversee the continuous development of the most robust set of social and environmental corporate performance metrics on the planet, and they're getting tweaked all the time, and so you ask a great question, and the best answer to that is for us not to take whatever the current iteration of it is as if it's chiseled on tablets from Mount Sinai. This just reflects the best insight we have today. And the only thing we know is that we'll be smarter tomorrow than we are today, and then we'll change the standards to reflect that. One thing that your listeners might be interested in is the most important feedback that we get on the standards is actually from users. And so during almost every – I don't know if it's every year, every sort of version term, every 2 or 3 years, we get between 3,000 and 4,000 individual lines of feedback from users of the B Impact Assessment that highlight areas that need clarification, amendment, or areas or point out blind spots that we have. And so the standards would not evolve without the input, not only of the experts on the Standards Advisory Council, but the experts that are out there running real businesses all around the world who can point out things that we're missing or misrepresenting or about which we're unclear.
That sounds great. I'm just going to mention one of them now because I do it myself, and I was wondering if how much it occurred to any of you in any conversations. I did a long blog post fairly recently about diversity, and I think people immediately spring to racial diversity, and if not, gender balance, which is very important as well, and then LGBTQ sexuality diversity as well. And then I wrote the whole thing and put it out, and I forgot, even though it's something that's enormously relevant in the industry I work in, but ageism is something that I completely forgot to mention, and went, that's really weird, because it is a really big thing. Is that something that's come up in your conversations at all?
Yeah, absolutely, and in fact, I've been appropriately smacked for forgetting ageism. We all have our blind spots. Some of them more lasting than others. And the thing that we cultivate most here, hopefully at B-Lab, is a humility and listening skills. And so especially on difficult issues around inclusion, I think all of us continuously make mistakes. And I think the best thing we can do is to assume good intentions and then correct them as quickly as we can, you know. And we have one of our guiding principles here at B-Lab is that we fail forward. And so whether it's not uplifting ageism in talking about all the different dimensions of diversity and inclusion, or talking about diversity and inclusion but not acting on it, which is also like a fairly typical thing in the world generally, in the corporate world no differently, we have to hold ourselves accountable. And I think one of the most powerful things about the B Corp community that I've seen is what's happened over the last year, where on this very issue, we realized that we were not doing nearly enough as individual businesses or as a community to do the very hard work to build more inclusive businesses and to move ourselves collectively towards a more inclusive economy. And so last year, we launched the B Corp Inclusive Economy Challenge, where we developed a specific set of metrics, a bunch of resource guides and best practice tools and other things to help companies identify and then act upon those areas around diversity, inclusion, equity that were most important to them, while pointing them in the right direction for the areas that we and our Standards Advisory Council had deemed sort of the most high impact areas around that topic. And it's been pretty fascinating. It's the very first time in the first 10 years of the B Corp movement where we have issued a tangible call to action to the B Corps beyond becoming a B Corp and inviting others to join us broadly. This is the very first targeted call to action that we'd ever done. And there are hundreds and hundreds of B Corps that have taken the challenge, which basically amounted to them picking any three of those inclusive economy metrics and setting goals for improvement over the next 12 months. So we've had hundreds of companies access those resources, set concrete goals, and we'll know within the next 30 days like where we are on that. We'll be sharing all of that information at our annual B Corp gathering this October. But I want to say there's over 700 or 800 companies that have accessed those resources around inclusion. And I think somewhere between 200 and 300 companies have actually set goals for improvement. And so that to me is quite powerful and an example of our own continuous learning process. And that in this particular issue, we felt that it was necessary for us to lift it up specifically and to give people concrete tools and resources and to set out a challenge for people to accept to move the needle. And so your specific example around inclusion resonates with me personally and also clearly resonates with the B Corp community because it's the single thing that we lifted up in the last 12 months to focus on collectively.
That's great. Just as a sort of a question about a slightly quirky thing that maybe if I've noticed it, maybe other people will. You need 80 points out of 200 to be classified as a B Corp, which, if my math is right, is like 4 out of 10. How come it's low, I guess?
Yeah. No, there's no question. And so the issue is, and this may be a very poor metaphor for anybody outside the U.S., but or for people that don't like sports, but if you're get a hit 4 out of 10 times in baseball, you're batting 400. It's 40%. You're in the Hall of Fame.
Yeah.
And the way we look at it is managing your business to be a profitable business, but that also generates measurable positive impact on society and environment. Is like being a Hall of Fame baseball player in that there are always many more things that we're not doing than we are. And so the more you work on sustainability or social justice, the more you realize how far there is to go. And I think that's true for B Corp certification. And so when we were first developing the standards and we were working with companies like Seventh Generation, Method Home Products, Patagonia, Pura Vida Coffee. These were folks that were already considered leaders in their industries and in the sort of corporate responsibility, sustainability movements. And when they went through a beta version of the B impact assessment, they were all scoring sort of in the 90s, you know, on our weighted tool. And one, the company that myself and one of the other co-founders was running before this, we scored like the high 60s.
Wow.
That seemed like, when we looked at that, seemed about right, meaning it would seem really counterproductive to create a standard for responsible business that Patagonia didn't meet.
Yeah.
You know, and yet, even though we were doing some very cool things at And1, we didn't think about this nearly like Patagonia did or Seventh Generation or Method did. We were, that was not who we were at our core DNA. And so the fact that we were doing some cool things and we were within sight of a goal, but would have to do some real work to get there, the combination of those two or three data points led us to the conclusion to set the bar at 80, because it felt like a thing that we should have to work towards. If we were at N1, it might take us a little bit, but if we wanted to do it, it would be within reach. And it seemed like something that recognized leaders like Seventh Generation Method or Patagonia ought to be able to say, yes, these sets of standards reflect both the amount of stuff I'm already doing, but importantly also all the stuff that I know that I'm not doing. And those companies are the first to tell you all the things that they're not doing. That's one of the things I admire about them the most, is that the most self-critical, self-aware people I know are the leaders within the B Corp community who are not afraid of that transparency and saying, yeah, I'm scoring a 95. That's fantastic, and it puts me in a community of leaders, but there's still so much more distance I have to cover, and I'm looking forward to that. It becomes a great employee engagement tool for us to work together on those areas that we want to improve. And so it totally resonates with me that it feels like it's a low bar, but no company does everything well. Some companies are great environmentally and not as focused on community. Some folks are great on community but not as strong on worker issues. No company does everything perfectly, and even those that are doing wonderfully on the environment know that there's a lot more that they can be doing. And so that's why we ended up with 80 as the bar, and why we think 80 reflects more a Hall of Fame performance than a failing biology test.
Yeah, it feels very much like a lot of good things. It's a mountain with no top, that you can always improve. You know, even if you totally worked out these areas, there's always something else. And if there isn't something else, you should look for something else, because, you know, being perfect is a kind of impossibility, particularly if you're a corporation.
That's right. And Ben, one of the things that's like so important, and this is back to the spirit of continuous improvement, is becoming certified is not the destination, right? It's just a milestone on the journey to becoming a more high-impact business. And so it's an important milestone. It puts you in a community of leaders and gives you a real asset you can use to engage employees and attract customers and long-term capital. But there are also B Corps who work every year to improve their score. And so the reason why we don't do a pass-fail grading system, but we actually have point scoring, is because people work very hard to improve their score. The company Method that I mentioned before, like, they just literally had a street party with their entire office down on Commercial Street in your area out on the West Coast to celebrate the fact that they had raised their score this year to 146.
Wow.
And that they're incredibly proud, not just that they're a B Corp, but that they're actually improving every year. And we've created a list of companies like the Fortune 500, but for impact, not for size, or like the Inc. 5000 for impact, not just for speed of growth. And that, we call that the best for the world list. And that'll be released in just a couple weeks. I think it's on September 12th. And so every year we highlight those companies that have not only met the minimum bar for certification, but have actually achieved a score in the top 10% of that particular impact area. So you might be best for the world for workers, right? Or best for the world for the environment, as well as, of course, overall. And so we try to celebrate those companies, not just to have met the bar to be a B Corp, but to recognize it's only a step on the journey to compete to be best for the world.
Well, that's great. I think that's actually a really positive note to end on. I think for people who haven't come across this as an entity and as a thing so far, there's a huge amount to take in and think about. But I think, you know, with any large scale, hopefully global and hopefully very long term project, it's always going to start at one place and build and build and build. So anyone listening to this, you know, there's a huge amount to really get your teeth into, get your mind into. Is there anywhere they should go to next to find out more?
Yeah, thanks for asking. I'd say if you want to learn about B Corp, you can go to bcorporation.net, just the letter B in corporation, all spelled out, .net. But any company, whether or not they ever want to be a B Corp or not, can use our tools for free and in a confidential way to measure and manage their impact. And so for that, you can go directly to our impact management site, which is called bimpactassessment.net. Just again, the letter B, impactassessment.net. And there you can go right in and use the tools. And you don't ever have to talk to anybody at B-Lab. You don't ever have to, you know, do anything other than use these tools that are the product of the collective wisdom of this community over the last 10 years. And you get to assess yourself, benchmark your performance, see case studies and best practices from hundreds of companies around the world. And that's a free tool available to anybody. And so we would encourage anybody that wants to use their business as a force for good to become a part of the B Corp movement, whether or not they ever are interested or able to earn certification.
That's great. Well, again, thank you so much for your time, Jay. And thank you so much for the difference you're making in the world. I think, you know, a lot of these great things happen as a result of, you know, some small fountainheads, which are, you know, creating a lot more of the stuff themselves. And I'm sure you seem like the kind of modest person who won't want to get into that too much, but, you know, there's a lot of great consequences happening as a result of your actions. So thank you so much for that.
Thank you, Ben. That means a ton. I appreciate it.
Cool. Well, thanks very much. And I'll put this up in a week or two and I'll send it to you when it's done.
That's great. And when you do, we'll obviously be thrilled to amplify it through our social, and Kaylee will help with that.
Great.
It's a ton, Ben.
Okay. Thanks, Jake.
All right. Take care now. Bye-bye.
Thanks.
If this is a podcast, then what's Christmas?